From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West.
I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Jack the Ripper, but not the Ripper himself, the murderer. We're talking about the women he killed. The historian Hallie Rubenhold says in the telling of that gruesome story, the women often come to us as empty shells. So she's fixing that. They weren't all prostitutes, by the way. They were poor and desperate, and women who had the cards stacked against them from the beginning. We'll be right back.
I'm Andrew Becker, the news director here at KUER. Our newsroom is growing, with new reporters set to join us in the coming months. In the meantime, we want to know, what issues should we be covering where you live? What stories should we be telling in your community? Help us improve our coverage of Utah by answering a few short questions. Go to KUER.org and click Community Feedback Form under the About tab.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's easy to remember the name Jack the Ripper. It's kind of the perfect nickname because it encompasses the bloody nature of the crime. And whoever Jack the Ripper was, we still don't know. Whoever he was, he went on a bloody murder spree in the summer and fall of 1888 in a poor section of London called Whitechapel. He killed and mutilated at least five women. But why don't we remember the names of those women? Polly, Mary Jane, Liz, Kate, Annie. The writer and historian Hallie Rubenhold says, we think we know who they are. The story that has come to us is that they were prostitutes, but really only two of them were. And Rubenhold says, in fact, the real story of these women has become entangled in a web of assumptions and unfounded speculation. She says this impression was set in place at a time when women had no voice and few rights, when poor people were thought of as lazy and degenerate. And these women were poor, and they were hungry, and most of them were homeless. Most of them had been abused, had fallen on hard times. Here's how she puts it in her book. For more than 130 years, we all have embraced the dusty parcel we were handed. Hallie Rubenhold tells the real stories of these women in her book. It's called The Five. She's an historian and a frequent consultant on period dramas. Her book, The Covent Garden Ladies, was the inspiration for the Hulu series Harlots. So, as you can tell, she has an interest in prostitution in history, and that's what got her started on this book.
I wanted to tell a story similar to the stories that I told before about 18th century women who were involved in prostitution. And so I approached this book and writing this book from the perspective of, well, you know, who were the most famous sex workers in the 19th century? Well, that will be the victims of Jack the Ripper. Mm. And I want to write their stories. Mm. And of course, that was not at all what I found when I started doing the research. It took me off in a completely different direction, and I found something completely contrary to what I expected to find when I started out.
How did you react when it first occurred to you that, wait a minute, we can't say that all of these women were prostitutes? I mean, what did you think about that, the fact that you yourself sort of just assumed that that was the case?
Yeah, I mean, that to me was, you know, a real epiphany moment. I mean, it was extraordinary, because when I started to do this research, I expected to find lots of evidence that these women were active in the sex trade. And I found evidence for two of them, for Elizabeth Stride and for Mary Jane Kelly. But the other three, there really was absolutely no conclusive evidence whatsoever. And what I did find was that there was a vast amount of evidence that these women were actually homeless and they were addicts. And that was really the source of their problems and why they were where they were when they were killed.
It's important to say that you're not really interested in retelling the part of the story that involves the gore and the gruesome details. And I guess this is pretty obvious. Explain why that part of the story, the gory part, has always been such a draw. Why has that been such an element of this story for so long, do you think?
Well, I think that, you know, there are a lot of factors here. I think one is this is the ultimate unsolved murder mystery. I mean, it's probably the most famous series of murders in history. and it's unsolved. And so, you know, there is a desire to examine the wounds, to examine the way the women were killed, to give people a sense of potentially clues as to who the Ripper actually was. But I think, you know, the way in which they were murdered, which was so fiendish and so awful. Do you know what? I'm not even going to describe it here because I think that's, you know, if you want to read about it, there's plenty on the internet and there are literally libraries of books that have been written about it. And I deliberately kept that out because that's another story in itself. That's not part of a life story, that's part of a death story. Mm-hmm. And it's part of what follows on from death, which is the only identity these women have ever really had has been in death.
Yeah.
And I really wanted to reverse that and roll that back.
One of the things you, and we'll get back to this a little bit later in the program, is what the Ripper represents, which is, as you explain it later in the book, is about our own, and maybe the Victorian obsession or maybe even the modern obsession with this mythology about women, the Madonna slash whore, that does seem to get to this obsession that exists that you deal with.
Yeah, the way in which the murders were written about, and very much in keeping with the way Victorians viewed the world, is, you know, there are the kind of good women and they're bad women, and bad women deserve to be punished. And so the way in which these women were written about after they had been murdered, the way in which the murders were written about was slightly cautionary, you know, and it was to sort of show the newspaper reading public, you know, that there were moral boundaries for female behavior. So, you know, any woman who was out at night by herself in the worst part of town, well, was suspect. You know, why was she there? Well, she had to have failed. She had to have morally failed as a woman. To be in that type of circumstance. And as long as we are continuing to tell that story in that framework, we're still adhering to that value set, which really, really deserves to be interrogated and questioned.
The point you focus on in the book, one of the many ways, is, as you say, the murders, of course, the brutality of the murders were shocking, but they exposed a fact that's crucial, some context that's important to understand, that the poor in London lived in, as you put it, unspeakably horrendous conditions.
Throughout history in London, the poor lived in terrible conditions. And, you know, I often say this to people after having done a lot of work in the 18th century, the conditions were not much better then. However, they were really coming to the attention of the newspaper reading public, of the literate middle classes, in the 19th century when you had more and more reformers, a greater sense of literacy, and people, you know, studying the lives of the poor and saying this is wrong and something needs to change here and writing about it. And so we have this incredible, these accounts, you know, resources of what the social reformers and journalists, investigative journalists, saw when they went into the poorest parts of town and they lived with poor families in some cases. And, you know, housing was very poor. And a lot of housing had been cleared away for developments, for railway developments, for the expansion of road networks. And so you had more and more poor, lower-income people forced into smaller pockets of a very poor, older housing that wasn't invested in. And you had things like families of, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 people living in a room of about 10 foot by 8 foot, you know, maybe 1 or 2 rooms. The actual conditions of the buildings were not wonderful. There was a lot of degradation of the material structure. So, you know, things like you go up a set of stairs and you could put your foot right through the stairs because the wood was rotting. But there were vermin, and the ceilings were coming in, the chimneys smoked, and it bred disease. There was very little ventilation. It, you know, fresh water was very hard to come by as well. And you know, the sewage system didn't work especially well. So you had sewage mixing with wastewater. You had people unable to get fresh water using wastewater to cook with. Mm. And not surprisingly, you know, the cholera was rife. There were numerous cholera outbreaks in London. You know, and things like typhoid as well. You know, absolutely unspeakable conditions.
It's interesting you go back 1 year before the murders to 1887 to kind of set up two things that are going on. One is being celebrated. Of course, it's the Golden Jubilee for Queen Victoria. Big deal there, of course. And then the other wasn't about celebrations and picnics. This was that Britain was caught up in this terrible employment crisis, which meant that in the center of London, there were hundreds, thousands of people who were looking for work. This was a massive homeless population developing.
Exactly, exactly. Absolutely shocking. And, you know, as I point out in the book, what you're referring to evolved into what were called the Trafalgar Square riots.
Yeah.
And this is something which, I mean, it has almost been erased from the history books. Mm. And it's so interesting how we choose to tell history and what we choose to omit and what we choose to talk about. You know, and London was a city much like New York, much like Chicago and any of these other big cities in 19th centuries, you know, a city of opposites, a city of contrasts. You know, you had the very wealthy and you had the very, very poor. Mm-hmm. And the story of these women fit into that story of the poor and also the stories that we don't tell. We would much rather tell the story of Queen Victoria and the Golden Jubilee and mm-hmm. the story of the aristocracy and the story of, you know, the beauty and the grandeur and the splendor that we imagine the Victorian era to be, but that wasn't the experience for all people.
You mentioned some of the stories of the time. A man who was a painter, a Mr. Asheville, you write about briefly, he didn't have any work for 12 months. He spent more than a month sleeping out of doors. Some of the victims, in fact, slept outside. They were basically homeless. I mean, this was another
yes.
part that hadn't occurred to me.
Yes. I mean, this is, as I said, you know, this is like the piece of the puzzle that has been left out of the Ripper story. We don't consider the homeless population and the circumstances surrounding poor people at this time, and especially not these women. And these women were, if not homeless at the time they were murdered, well, at least three were, mm-hmm. then they had experienced periods of vagrancy, with the exception of Mary Jane Kelly, who was the only confirmed sex worker. But Polly Nichols, the first victim, Annie Chapman, the second victim, Catherine Eddowes, the third victim, were all known to have slept rough, as we say in the UK, and experienced homelessness. In fact, the lodging houses in which they lived, and the lodging houses were temporary accommodation where you could buy a bed by the night for 4 pence for a single bed and 8 pence for a double bed. These were called homes for the homeless, people with no fixed abode. And what happened was you, being homeless, meant you kind of bounced between the lodging houses and sleeping on the street. You know, if ever you got some money, you could then go to a lodging house. If things got absolutely desperate, you could go to a casual ward, and a casual ward was like a short-term workhouse where you could work in exchange for a bed for one night or two nights. And it was, you know, these were terrible conditions also. You know, the work was grueling and they fed you terribly, and there was a huge amount of exploitation. And people tried to avoid the casual wards where they could, but the homeless population bounced between these three things. That was what it meant to be homeless. In the same way today, it's in the United States, you know, being homeless isn't always sleeping on the street. Sometimes, you know, you're sleeping in an RV. Sometimes you're sleeping in your car. Sometimes you're on somebody's couch for a couple nights. Sometimes you're in a hotel, in a motel room. And, you know, it's the same sort of thing. And this is what these women faced. Yeah. They were women with no fixed abode.
As you said, we can only say for certainty that two of these women worked in the sex trade, were prostitutes. But prostitution
yes.
as you say, was a fact of life for some poor women.
Absolutely.
And we'll get into the question of human trafficking as we go. That's another fascinating part of the story. But you do say that there was this sense that these women resorted to what was called casual prostitution. But you say it's wrong to believe they all did. And in fact, you talk about how these women were incredibly inventive when it came to trying to find money to stay out of those workhouses and survive.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, one of the things that we overlook that we don't discuss is what I like to call the economy of the slum, which is, beggars begging from beggars. There is always a penny to be spared for somebody who hasn't had anything to eat that day or anything to drink that day. There was a real culture of, if you've earned 3 pence and you know somebody who's desperate, you give one of those pennies away to that person. And by that way, that person was able to earn some subsistence. But then, there were other things you could do. You were constantly pawning things. You know, the pawnbroker was one of the most ubiquitous shops in poor areas. And that way, you could pawn anything you had. You could pawn, a skirt that you were wearing. You could pawn a pair of shoes if it meant you could get something to eat or drink or somewhere to sleep that night. And then also, there were odd jobs as well. You could do odd cleaning jobs. There were obviously factory jobs. There were laundry jobs and these types of things. Those were perhaps more permanent employment. But there were odd jobs around. So there were ways in which people could make shift and they could get some extra money. So this idea that all women relied on prostitution is just erroneous. Especially, your sexual capital as a woman is going to diminish the older you get. So while, when you're 17 or 18, it might be easy to make money, it's not going to be that easy to make money when you're 42.
One of the things you write about is this sort of the attitude of the time. It appeared to the moral middle class of the country that, as you put it, every good and righteous instinct in human relations was eroding. So what were the middle class sensibilities and how did they play into the way these women were perceived after they were killed and, the myths that sort of came to be?
Well, the middle class sensibilities are what we associate with the Victorian era.
Yeah.
They are, the married woman at the center of the family who is a mother, who is a good mother, who superintends over her children's lives and their educations and looks after her husband and the husband who provides, and everybody is church going and they don't drink and they are good Samaritans and they do everything that they are supposed to do and they are good Christians. The reality is that people's lives were much more complicated. And this was not possible for most people, especially when people were facing huge amounts of inequality. And misfortune could mean, if you lose your husband, who is the breadwinner of the house, you are left with nothing as a woman because women's work simply didn't pay. So you could not be the breadwinner. You had to throw your lot in with a man. And sometimes this meant bending the rules.
Yeah.
This meant coupling, getting together with somebody outside of marriage, and already you're on a downward slope if you're doing that and you're a woman.
So, you mentioned that some of the newspaper accounts said that these lodging houses, because these weren't married couples, were brothels in all but name, basically.
That was the impression. And the impression was because, this is a really interesting thing you raise, because what I've just described is the middle class, the standard Victorian set of values. If you were poor, what historians have found, and certainly what journalists and social explorers and missionaries were finding about the the working classes, the poor in, mm-hmm. in the 19th century in the cities, was that they had a completely different set of values when it came to sex and relationships.
Yeah.
And, you know, you lost your breadwinner, well, you better find another one. And people recoupled really quickly. You know, a man leaves a woman and she's found another man by the next day. And she's living with him and she's living out of wedlock. And a lot of people lived out of wedlock because it was practical for various reasons. A lot of people had very itinerant jobs. If a man took off and you didn't know where he was because his job meant he had to go, you know, do a laboring job somewhere else and you had no way of communicating with him, it was much more practical for you not to be married so you could find another man to look after you in his absence. Now, Victorian middle class, the Victorian middle classes would look upon any woman who lived by these rules as a whore.
Yeah.
As a prostitute, because she would have had children by other men. And so this condemnation comes through. Certainly, when they look at the lifestyles of the poor and what they did to get by in those slums.
Interesting. You mentioned how the commissioner of the Metropolitan Police had done some figuring, and he worked it out that most of the women in these lodging houses, in fact, were not at all engaged in sex work. So people were knew it at the time, or some knew it at the time, but the public and the newspapers, I guess, were probably, as you say, they were trying to get a lot of attention by writing about these seedy details of slum life. They weren't believing it or paying that much attention to the reality, I suppose.
I think it's questionable how much the newspaper reading public actually did know about how the poor lived. Mm-hmm. There are accounts by writers, somebody called William Booth, who was the father of the Salvation Army. And he wrote this fantastic book called Darkest England and the Way Out, which was a study of the poor and the poor on the streets. And he really examined the lives of the homeless as well. And one of the things he says is, he says, you know, the ordinary person, the Londoner, the middle class Victorian, really is completely ignorant of what is going on here on the streets. And, you know, they just don't know how people are living and how many homeless people there are, how many people without beds there are at any given night. And I think that's important to bear in mind. So how much the better off classes knew really is questionable.
What was the role of literature or writers like Dickens in conveying what was happening or what wasn't happening on the streets?
Well, Dickens very much, you know, tapped into this middle class concern about morality, about the condition of people's lives, about the hypocrisy in society, you know, and by turning these into very entertaining tales that were serialized, he certainly captured their imagination. But there were a lot of other investigative writers, George Sim, for example, who went in and wrote series of articles about how the poor were living, which also highlighted how desperate people were. And in fact, you know, this did do good because what it did was it recruited more people to charitable causes. It was conscious raising in terms of the plight of the poor. And so it did have an effect. I mean, if you go back 100 years earlier to the 18th century, there was very little of this around. There were a handful of people who were reformers. But by the 19th century, this had really, you know, there's a real groundswell of interest in trying to improve people's lives.
Hallie Rubenhold, her book is called The Five, The Untold Lives of the Women Killed by Jack the Ripper. She joined us from the studios of the BBC in London. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. A lot of people want to know, does Doug really read all those books? The answer, yeah, he does. No one really knows how, but we do know that he gets up very early. If you want to try keeping up with him, you can buy the book by clicking on the indie bookstores, Amazon, or Audible links at the bottom of the episode page. If you do, some of the proceeds go to support Radio West. So thanks for that, and thanks for listening. Here's the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Jack the Ripper, not the Ripper himself, not the murderer. We're talking about the women he killed. The historian Hallie Rubenhold says in the telling of the gruesome story, the women in that story have come to us as empty shells. So she's fixing that. They weren't prostitutes who had it coming. In fact, most of them weren't prostitutes. They were poor women and desperate women. Her book is called The Five, The Untold Lives of the Women Killed by Jack the Ripper. Hallie Rubenhold joined us from the studios of the BBC in London. Explain why it was that when a body was discovered in these murders, the police and then ultimately the public believed it was a prostitute and that sex had to have been involved. Because the fact is, Jack the Ripper never had sex with the victims. And it's interesting, this idea that sex for some reason had to be involved in these crimes.
Yeah. I mean, this is a very, very obvious reason. And it's because a woman outside, alone, in the worst part of town, at night, by herself, had to be a prostitute.
Yeah.
I mean, that is the only reason. And what is even more interesting is that the year before these murders, in 1887, there was a very interesting landmark case about a seamstress by the name of Elizabeth Cass, who had gone out. It was summer, you know, in summer in England, it doesn't get dark until probably about 10 o'clock at night in the height of summer. And she had gone out to see the illuminations for Queen Victoria's Jubilee. And she'd gone down Regent Street. And Regent Street at the time was one of the places where the prostitutes would perambulate in the evening. And she had her collar felt by a police officer who said, "I know you, you're a prostitute." And she protested that she wasn't. And her employer came forward and said she absolutely wasn't. And she was made to stand trial. And eventually it turned out that she wasn't, and that the police officer had ended up perjuring himself, saying that she was. And because of this, there were a series of guidelines that were passed which said, which basically told the police who was and who wasn't a prostitute and how you could identify them. So the idea that any woman out late at night after 1887, after July 1887, could be called a prostitute, that was a sort of holdover. You know, it was a set of societal beliefs that were governing those responses rather than what the law was actually saying at that time, which I think is very interesting.
There were no signs of struggle in these murders. The murders seem to have taken place, as you put it in the book, in complete silence.
Yes.
Now explain why this is so important.
Well, I think this is very important because I believe that the women were killed in their sleep. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a lot of evidence to suggest this. I mean, it's logic. It stands to reason because there was no evidence that they had sex. The women were killed in reclining positions, mm-hmm. not lying down, but reclining. And when you're sleeping rough, you're generally with your back up against a wall. Actually, all of these women's backs were facing walls when their bodies were found. But more importantly, there was no struggle. There was no noise. And we know, for example, well, three of them were known to sleep rough. After Catherine Eddowes was murdered, a group of women who slept rough with her and knew her from sleeping on the streets came forward and said, "She used to sleep rough with us." Mm. Annie Chapman, where her body was found a couple days later, a man was found sleeping in the very position where she was killed. So there, to me, that is quite overwhelming in terms of evidence, whereas there is no evidence, zero evidence, that they were in the places they were because they were soliciting. It's only been surmised, it's only been just guessed at that was the reason why they were there.
Mm. Well, I want to get to the stories of some of the women, but let me just get this out of the way, because it's important to say there wasn't an actual trial, and of course no justice for the victims. And so I guess the only thing we really have to go on in terms of closure or answers were these coroner inquests.
Yes.
How difficult was it to work through a coroner inquest as opposed to like trial transcripts in terms of running down what may have happened?
Well, it's interesting. I think it's worth explaining. So if there is a death and there is no trial, there is nobody to bring to trial, then the coroner has to determine what the cause of death is.
Yeah.
And so you go through a process which is similar to a trial, which involves the coroner and a jury and witnesses who give testimony about what they know about the circumstances leading up to the death and the death itself. So the coroner's inquests are very, very important in terms of what they tell us. In fact, in terms of ripperology, they're one of the major sources from which the evidence is drawn. However, for the five women, for the five individual inquests that were held, we only have the actual documents for two of the women.
Yeah.
The other three are missing. So all we have to go on are sensationalized 19th century newspaper reports. And if you lay out 10 newspapers, you get 10 different readings of what was actually said at these inquests. So what I found going through this was, first of all, I was absolutely shocked that people who have written books in suspectology and mm-hmm. trying to figure out who Jack the Ripper was have said with such certainty, based on these totally uncertain sources, that, you know, X was a fact and Y was a fact. Well, we don't know that. We simply don't know that at all, especially if it's reported in a newspaper and if it varies from newspaper to newspaper. So actually sorting through all of this was, I mean, it was like doing it with a fine-tooth comb and trying to figure out what was the most logical thing and, you know, constantly trying to cross-reference it with historical precedent and what else we know, and building a case that way.
It's hard to pick one or two of these stories. Let me tease out a few here. Let's start with Catherine Eddowes. Her father worked in the tin trade. Interesting, he was a kind of a union agitator. He got into a labor dispute.
Yeah.
Was sentenced to 2 months of hard labor. Talk a little bit about Catherine's beginnings, because her mother had to play the role of a dutiful wife, perpetual childbearing. It seems like then the limited role of women at the time, that really came out to me as the circumstances for Catherine Eddowes' beginning.
Yeah, it's interesting. So you mentioned her father was a union agitator. She was born in a city in the Midlands, what we call the Black Country today. And that was really the heart of the Industrial Revolution in the 19th century. So these were factory towns. And so this is like your quintessential Industrial Revolution factory experience. And when her father got out of jail, he had to leave town because he would have been blacklisted. And the union helped place him, as the union often did, in work in London. And that's where she was raised. She was a baby when she was taken to London. She came from a very large family. Her mother had 12 children, and she was the middle sister. Only 10 survived. And Catherine was very fortunate in that at a time when, roughly about 1850, only about 50% of women, working class, of women in general, actually, could sign their names. Catherine was sent to school, was sent to a charity school right near her father's work, and was given an education and was taught music and was taught to read and write. And this put her in good stead later in her life. Unfortunately, her mother died when she was a young teenager, and then her father died shortly thereafter, and the family was split up. And the younger children went into the workhouse. The elder sisters tried to look after Catherine by sending her back off to her relatives in Wolverhampton. And the family was always spread out from that point. The children went on their own ways, which seems incredibly sad.
So sad that she was split up from her siblings. Has to go, first she goes to live with one uncle, then another. She's put out to work immediately. And as you say, never really felt like she belonged in any part of a family. And then she ends up marrying this man named Tom Conway.
Except she didn't marry
him. She lives with him.
Yes.
And she lives this really interesting, I have to say, sounds terrible, but she becomes kind of a peddler with him. They live this really transient existence.
Yeah, like gypsies almost.
Yeah.
And they were, he had been a soldier in India. He had suffered with a medical condition. We're not quite sure what it was, but they called it rheumatism. It may very well have been asthma from its description, because they didn't really know what asthma was back then. But it made him unfit to be a soldier. And so he took to peddling ballads and something called chapbooks. And chapbooks were little story books. And it was said, interestingly, that he was the one who wrote these ballads. But the research that I did indicated that Thomas Conway was actually illiterate. He couldn't even sign his name. But the person in the relationship who was literate was Catherine.
Right.
So if anybody was writing the ballads, it was her. And they would travel from town to town, marketplace to marketplace, singing and performing, doing street performance and selling these ballads. And they also sold them at hangings as well.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. They set up shop at at least one public hanging. That was interesting. I guess that's where the traffic was, though, I guess.
Yeah. That's where it was. And the person, so there is a ballad that exists. I mean, we're not absolutely 100% sure that it was Catherine, but it could very well be her own composition, because it was actually the hanging of her distant cousin, who had basically murdered his fiance in a fit of rage.
It's such a sad story. She had one baby die of malnutrition in her arms.
Yeah. It's terrible. They had done well enough to move to London and set up. And I think Thomas Conway felt that he wanted to try his hand in London. And they didn't do very well. Unfortunately, they were very, very poor. Mm-hmm. And so they didn't have enough food. And one of her children died. She also had other children. She had another child who died. We don't know the circumstances around his death, but he was there, and then suddenly he wasn't after around the age of 2.
What would become of poor women with illegitimate children? Talk a little bit about those circumstances.
Well, it really depended. They were always frowned upon. And certainly they were frowned upon by the middle classes. But as I've mentioned, the poor had a very different set of moral values. And so people didn't ask questions. Your neighbors didn't ask if the child was legitimate or not. However, say in the case of Catherine Eddowes, Catherine's older sisters all had tried to lead respectable lives and were kind of upstanding lower class Victorian women who were married and had children. And what they must have made of Catherine, well, I mean, we have a sense of it because her sisters left interviews with newspapers. And one of them said that Catherine was a bit of a disgrace, actually, to them. And especially when Thomas Conway started beating her up.
Yeah.
And there was this sort of view in the 19th century that a woman who was beaten deserved it. Yeah. It was her own fault. She brought it on herself.
She takes up with a man named John Kelly. And they were, I guess this gets us back to what we were talking about earlier. You say companions committed to each other's daily survival. This is often the kinds of relationships that happened.
Yes. Well, she and Thomas Conway go their own separate ways at some point. And obviously, it was a very abusive relationship. And then she finds this other man, John Kelly, who's quite placid by comparison. By this time, Catherine was really quite a heavy drinker, an alcoholic.
Yeah.
And she found a companion who was exactly like her and drank a lot. And basically, they lived hand to mouth and they drank away most of their earnings. And the final couple of days of her life, as told by John Kelly, I think provides quite a good snapshot of what her existence with him must have been like, which was just, you know, odd jobs, earning money, which gave you enough to eat and drink and maybe have somewhere to sleep that night. And if you didn't have somewhere to sleep that night, you know, you slept on the streets until the next day when it started all over again.
Mm. You write this, that what mattered most to her in those final days were the here and now, getting the drink that dulled her pain and the food that stopped the hunger. That was about it for her life. It's awful.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It is. But, you know, I mean, this is the life of so many addicts who live on the street today. It hasn't changed.
Let's talk about Mary Jane Kelly.
Sure.
Born in Limerick, 1863. It's hard to know much about her life, it seems, because you say not a single statement she made about her life before she arrived in London can actually be verified. It seems like she's reinventing herself or recreating an identity for herself.
Exactly. Well, we don't even know if she was born in Limerick.
Right.
You know, that's the other thing is she told half the people she spoke to, she told them she was Welsh. The other half, she said she was Irish. It's possible she was the child of Irish parents who had moved to Wales. It's uncertain what class she was from. There's a lot of indication that she was probably from a better class than what she claimed to be from when she was living in the slums. And of course, you wouldn't want to seem too highfalutin when you lived in the slums. But she certainly had skills and behaviors which would indicate she had an education which was beyond that of the sort of woman that she described that she was.
She left Cardiff for a gay house. Explain what that is and talk about how prostitutes couldn't live where they practiced their trade. This is another really important element to the story.
Yeah, it is. Things really changed in 1885 with the passing of the Criminal Law Amendment Act, which made brothels very hard to function. There was a real crackdown on them. And so obviously, you know, prostitution is still going to continue, but it's going to go underground a little bit more, and it's going to make things less straightforward for those involved in it. So Mary Jane Kelly lived with a landlady in Knightsbridge. And Knightsbridge was and still is quite a posh part of London. And Mary Jane Kelly practiced in the top end of prostitution in London. However, she would go into Piccadilly, which was the center of prostitution, whether it was high-class prostitution or middling prostitution or even lower-ranking prostitution. You would work out of the West End. And she would have seen her clientele there. But the way in which she saw them, it would have been prearranged in many cases. She would have been taken out to dinner by men and maybe taken to the music hall or taken to the theater. Or she would have spent a weekend with them and they would have done things like bought her dresses, taken her places. And then she would have spent the night with them. And sometimes she may have gone back to where she lived in Knightsbridge. But most of the time she would have gone to an accommodation house or a hotel where she could carry on with the men more discreetly.
How does she end up in France?
Well, this is, again, you know, very interesting. There is a lot to suggest in what was said about Mary Jane Kelly. Now, granted, everything we know about her has come to us secondhand because it's what people who knew her after her death said about her. And she had a boyfriend called Joseph Barnett, and most of what we know about her came from him. And Joseph Barnett said that, and also we know this from other testimony, that she did go to Paris, but that she came back because she didn't like the part. And what we know about this was that the late 19th century was a time when people trafficking was on the rise. And it's interesting that improvements in transportation mean that goods can be transported to market and in less time and across further distances. And those goods also included people. Now, a lot of women went perfectly willingly into brothels in France and Belgium and Germany from England, and the trade also worked the other way where they came to London from those countries. So she very well may have gone knowing that she was going to another situation, but had not really been apprised of what exactly it was going to entail. And we know that something went wrong because she left behind her trunks of clothing. And we also know that one of the first things that happened when a woman was entrapped into what was called a maison close in France or in Belgium is that they were made to wear the clothing provided to them by the house. So therefore, they racked up a debt to the madam for their clothing. And we know
these are techniques they're still using today, aren't they?
Absolutely. Yeah. Exactly. And it is really interesting to see how little prostitution has changed. In the 18th century, it was exactly the same way as well. And so Mary Jane had left her dresses behind. And we know this because she went with her madam when she lived in East London to try and collect these dresses back from the madam in the West End. And we don't know if she could get them back or not. Mm.
She escapes, basically, I guess, and there are interesting to hear these conflicting descriptions of her. On one hand, that she was sick of the life that she was leading, the other sense that maybe she was unashamed of the fact that this was her trade. The idea that she was a bit of a terror, that she could be fierce. I don't know. I'm just she was really intriguing as a personality. I'm trying to imagine how she seemed to really have a kind of a strong personality, a good sense of who she was, even though she was in these kind of desperate situations at times.
Yeah. I mean, she was also the youngest, which meant that she hadn't been ground down yet.
Yeah.
But making the move from high-class prostitution to really low-class prostitution, what would have been horrendous? You know, you don't go from riding around with men in their carriages and wearing beautiful dresses and being wined and dined in St. James to basically trawling for customers on the Ratcliffe Highway, which is where all the sailors would come in. That is really, really not going to be fun. That is going to be, you're going to be pretty miserable about that. And I think one of the things that Mary Jane does confide to the people who she spoke to, the women who lived around her, was that she was very, very actually unhappy underneath this mask that she had constructed over her. But that mask is part of what, you know, for many people who don't want to be in sex work, that is a necessary bit of armor.
Mm. The cards were stacked against these women, you say, from birth. Is that an important theme to all of this, just the circumstances that led them here?
Yes, I think so. Women didn't have a lot of choices in the 19th century. They didn't have opportunities. As I've mentioned before, work did not pay. Society did not design for women to be the breadwinner.
Yeah.
Therefore, they could not get work that would support them if they were by themselves. Therefore, they were trapped in situations where they couldn't better their lives.
You say that insisting Jack the Ripper killed prostitutes just made the story of these murders slightly more palatable. What was that about? This idea that if we just thought of them as prostitutes, we don't have to look at the actual circumstances and the actual conditions that are going on?
Yeah. Again, it bolsters this idea that these were bad women. And maybe the loss of bad women isn't as tragic as the loss of a woman who wasn't bad. And I say bad with quotation marks mm-hmm. around it. And so it makes it easier to accept because part of it, whether we openly subscribe to it or not, upholds a certain set of moral values which our society, you know, still clings to.
Let me ask you finally, it's interesting to hear you responding to questions about the reaction from this ripperology, this kind of subculture of people who dig into the details about this story. How are people reacting to the fact that you're really taking your focus away from the gore, taking your focus away from the mystery of the murderer and actually the women themselves? How are people reacting to that? Are you pleased with the way people are reacting, or is it just making you more depressed?
Well, I mean, there are two sets of reactions. One is obviously there are people who are not ripperologists, and actually some people who are ripper enthusiasts really are really, really pleased about this book. And
yeah,
I get people writing to me literally every day thanking me for writing this, and that means an enormous amount to me. I mean, it feels so good to be able to do something like this. And then the other side are ripperologists who can't see beyond the fact that I'm questioning the orthodoxy, mm-hmm. that I am undermining their years and years of effort to give name to the perpetrator, and that I am questioning the viability of the sources, that I am questioning everything really to do with what has been accepted and received knowledge about this case. And they are going absolutely berserk. And I'm getting hate mail, calling me a liar. I've been told that I have suppressed and ignored evidence because it didn't fit my so-called agenda, which is a feminist agenda. And I am told that I'm being compared to David Irving, the Holocaust denier.
Wow.
I'm being told that what I have done is tantamount to what he has done because I have perpetrated an enormous fraud on people by making them believe that this was the case. Rather than just actually looking at the evidence and seeing something else, which is what I saw.
Hallie Rubenhold, her book is The Five, The Untold Lives of the Women Killed by Jack the Ripper. She joined us from the studios of the BBC in London. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.